There is such a need right now for historians to put this moment in
It's
perspective.
hard for us to know right now what these next months will look like because we're also reacting to how historians are responding to what they are seeing.
These are humble but important contributions to trying to impact the public conversation and debate over what phenomena it is that we're experiencing at this present time. So we're in a moment where these things are percolating, not just into the news, but into government. And we have to be vigilant. And I think New Fascism Syllabus is here for that conversation.
Welcome to episode 186 of the Refuse Fascism podcast, a podcast brought to you by volunteers with Refuse Fascism. I'm Sam Goldman, one of those volunteers and host of the show. Refuse Fascism exposes, analyzes, and stands against the very real danger and threat of fascism coming to power in the United States. Your help is needed as we design our programming for a year where Refuse Fascism will be needed more than ever. Take a few minutes to fill out a survey contributing your thoughts on what you hope to hear on the pod this year. Your questions, your fears, what's keeping you up at night. We want to know all about it. So see the show notes, click the survey link, and let us know your thoughts. Cheers to everyone who goes the extra step and rates and reviews on Apple Podcasts, shares and comments on social media or YouTube, it helps us reach more listeners. After listening to today's show, take a sec, help us grow this community by writing a review and dropping 5 stars wherever you listen. Subscribe, follow, so you never miss an episode. In today's show, we're sharing an interview with Dr. Jennifer Evans and Dr. Brian Griffith, editors of the New Fascism Syllabus. But first, we need to talk about some developments from this past week as they relate to the fascist threat. So here we go, buckle in. First off, tomorrow, Monday, January 22nd, would have been the 51st anniversary of Roe v. Wade, but it is now the second year that such an anniversary is marked in the absence of the nationwide right to legal abortion. This is a discriminatory, dystopian, misogynist reality that must never be minimized, tolerated, or accommodated to. Here is Jessica Valenti speaking at a briefing on abortion rights hosted by Senate Democrats on January 17th, 2024.
Good morning. My name is Jessica Valenti, and since Roe was overturned, I've been documenting the harms caused by abortion bans in a newsletter called Abortion Every Day. I cover everything from legislation and court battles to anti-abortion strategy and language. But the topic that I find myself writing about most, I'm sorry to say, is suffering. And while Americans know about some of the suffering caused by abortion bans, thanks to the bravery of women like Dr. Denard, there are hundreds of other stories that go unreported. I have spoken to a 21-year-old woman in Texas who was denied an abortion even though her fetus developed without a head, and a hospital worker in South Carolina who watched a college student die after attempting to end her own pregnancy. I get more messages every day than I could ever possibly answer. And while I could share stories that would shock and sicken you in the way that I am shocked and sickened every single day doing this work, I wanted to use my time here to stress that this incredible suffering, this cruelty that treats American women as less than human, is all by design. Despite Republican assurances that cases like Dr. Denard's are the result of legislative growing pains or doctors simply not understanding the law, despite claims that their bans just need to be tweaked or clarified, I want to make clear that all of this pain and suffering was not just expected. It was planned for. Anti-abortion lawmakers and activists would have voters believe that they had no idea that this is what post-America, post-Roe America would look like. But they had 50 years to plan for this moment, and they made that plan carefully, strategically, and callously. Every raped child forced to give birth, every cancer patient denied care, and every woman arrested after having a miscarriage was accounted for and strategized over. But with Americans getting angrier and angrier at what abortion bans are doing to their families and communities, Republicans are desperate to hide that truth from voters. They need us to believe that they're not the cruel extremists that their laws show them to be. And they certainly don't want us to know that they planned for women's deaths in the same way they strategize over a talking point or a poll. And I mean that literally. For months, I have been tracking a conservative campaign to sow distrust in maternal mortality numbers. Republicans know that the data is going to show that their laws kill women, so they're preemptively claiming that maternal death numbers aren't accurate. Some states have even disbanded their maternal death review committees entirely, and because the people most likely to die are the most marginalized among us, their hope is that no one will care. I've also documented how the anti-abortion movement laid the groundwork over months to blame doctors for women's deaths, as if the people working under threat of losing their license or jail time are the problem, and not the laws that prevent them from doing their jobs. All of which is to say, when Republicans feign surprise or compassion over post-Roe horror stories, they are lying. They knew that women would suffer and die as a result of their laws. They decided it was a trade-off worth making, and everything they've done since Roe was overturned has been in service of hiding that fact. Most of those lies are hiding in plain sight. When Republicans tell Americans that the national 15-week ban they're proposing is a reasonable middle ground, they leave out the fact that the law would force women to carry non-viable pregnancies to term. Their compromise would do to any American capable of pregnancy what Texas tried to do to Kate Cox. And again, this is not an oversight. It is a deliberate part of a much broader extremist strategy. Right now, there is a quiet but well-funded campaign led by the most powerful anti-abortion groups in the country that is focused entirely on pressuring and forcing women to carry doomed pregnancies to term. They're not only trying to do away with exceptions for non-viable pregnancies, they're trying to eradicate prenatal testing altogether. It's a lot easier to force women to carry a dying fetus to term if they never get diagnosed to begin with. When I tell people about this, the question I get asked most often is why? Why would anyone want to deliberately create a world where women are forced to be walking coffins? It is inexplicable until you understand that this has nothing to do with families or babies, but enforcing a worldview that says it's women's job to be pregnant and to stay pregnant no matter what the cost or consequence. But because Republicans don't have the bravery to admit that truth, and because they're afraid of voters who are more pro-choice than ever, they lie. They talk about compassion because they know that their laws are cruel. They use the word consensus while passing bans that voters don't want. And they call Democrats extremists while fighting for the right to deny women life-saving abortions in emergency rooms. And because Republicans know that voters overwhelmingly oppose their bans, they claim to be softening on abortion by pushing one of the biggest lies in abortion politics, exceptions. Again and again, Republicans deliberately propose and pass exceptions that no one will ever qualify for. The only purpose they serve is to allow extremist lawmakers to feign moderation or pretend as if they've conceded something. And frankly, any Republican who claims that exceptions are real should have to do so in front of all the people who've been told that they do not qualify for care, even as they went septic or had their uteruses removed. They should have to defend themselves in front of women like Kate Cox and Dr. Denard, or Brittany Watts, who wasn't just denied care by a religious hospital when her water broke too early for her pregnancy to survive, but was arrested when she miscarried at home. The only Republican exception that holds an iota of truth is the one about women's lives, though not in the way that they think. When you look at any Republican life of the mother exception, they all contain a caveat. And that caveat says that women whose lives are at risk can be given abortions unless the risk is because she's suicidal. And I want to stress how telling that is. Republicans know that forcing people to be pregnant against their will make them want to kill themselves. And they enshrined into law that they don't care. In a moment when we are hearing so many extreme horror stories, it can be difficult, I think, to get back to that foundational cruelty. That to force someone to be pregnant against their will, for any reason, at any point, causes profound existential harm. Abortion is healthcare, but it is also freedom. That's why every abortion denied is a tragedy, and increasingly Americans understand that. They don't want the government involved in their decisions about pregnancy at any point. The first time I came to DC was in 1992. I was 13 years old, and my mother brought me here for the Pro-Choice March for Women's Lives. Maybe some of you were there. I remember men screaming at us from the sidelines, and I remember how confused I was over why they hated us so much. Today, my 13-year-old daughter is in the room, and it's her first time in Washington, and yet somehow she's here with less rights than I had 32 years ago, and I think that we should be ashamed of that. My deepest hope is that she doesn't need to follow in the steps of her mother and grandmother and come here decades from now to defend her daughter's humanity. Thank you for your time.
I want to add a few things. One, to these theocrats, as they made clear yesterday at their Summit for Life, aka Summit for Female Enslavement, their fight against abortion is nothing less than what they see as righteous spiritual warfare. Demolishing Roe was the floor, not the ceiling, for the theocratic movement, prepared and ready for a federal abortion ban embraced by the GOP, supported by a fascist-stacked judiciary, poised to dispense with the rule of law in order to tighten the chains of patriarchy, preventing access to abortion medication or even birth control pills. As more people are coaxed into the idea that a 15-week ban is somehow a compassionate compromise. Two, it is a losing tactic to rely on increasingly rigged elections that have at best slowed the impact for some women in some places, while turning a blind eye to the millions of women, girls, and others denied abortion care in their state right now. And the idea that we have to fight for women's civil rights state by state only normalizes the concept of women's fundamental rights being based on local public opinion. Seriously, would you accept the right for free speech only on the coasts, or the right to vote but not in the South, or the right to worship in only half of the country? Three, this country is at an unprecedented turning point. MAGA and Christian fascists have, as we've talked about on this show a lot, captured the Supreme Court, the Speaker of the House, many state governments, and more. They have declared in advance that any election they lose is, quote unquote, illegitimate. The norms are not holding. And let's be real, when we look at the norms for abortion rights in this country prior to Roe, the norms are not holding. And we should question if they were enough in the first place. Four, we are being told to plead for Democrats to run on abortion rights, which they are doing now, launching an advertising effort this week. But all evidence points to the obvious fact that they can win on abortion rights. But even if they win because of this, we don't actually win abortion rights. It still is not codified. And for decades, when the Democratic Party had the opportunity prior to this loss, they didn't. The Democratic Party has refused to fight for this for decades and led the decent people down this fatal path. Five, still needed are a people who refuse to relent until we win abortion on demand and without apology nationwide. And I know that talking to you, you are amongst those people. So get this demand up and out everywhere. Abortion on demand and without apology in the name of humanity. We refuse to accept a fascist America. Chalk it, banner drop it, put it on your window of your shop or dorm room, project it. See show notes for a link to print and post. Continuing to look at the impact of the Trump-stacked Supreme Court, the fascist majority this week expressed its willingness, unsurprisingly, to erode the Chevron deference, which is the precedent that courts should defer to a government agency's reasonable interpretation of an ambiguous statute. When they heard oral arguments for Relentless v. Department of Commerce and Loperbright v. Raimondo, which on first blush seems like silly and obscure cases about federal regulations requiring commercial fishing companies having to pay for third-party monitoring of their fishing practices. But really, they are well-funded, crafted cases that seek to overturn Chevron v. NRDC to destroy the administrative state. This is an effort to demolish the functioning of government, which many, like the Alliance for Defending Freedom, see as paving the way for courts to more efficiently control women's lives and erase trans folks' humanity. As Madiba Denny wrote, quote, Loperbright brings together all flavors of conservatives, original recipe, sour cream, and neo-Nazi, salt and vinegar, and tax evasion, and so on, because they all stand to benefit from transferring political power to judicial reactionaries, end quote. Going on to say, quote, Ending Chevron deference would make it open season for lawsuits challenging each and every regulation that serves the public interest rather than the interests of the far right, end quote. If you're still unsure just how dangerous this could be, take note from Mark Joseph Stern, who writes for Slate, who put it this way, quote, without Chevron deference, it'll be open season on each and every regulation, with underinformed courts playing pretend scientist, economist, and policymaker all at once. Securities fraud, banking secrecy, mercury pollution, asylum applications, healthcare funding, plus all manner of civil rights law, they are ultra vulnerable to judicial attack in Chevron's absence, end quote. We will be covering this more in future episodes, but recommend going back to our October 15th, 2023 episode, Ruling Through the Courts When They Don't Have the Votes, with Dahlia Lithwick for background. On last week's show, we spoke with Faisal Al-Jubri from Raices, Texas, about the horrendous cruelty increasing every day at the border and across Texas. Go back and listen. Since then, Governor Abbott has plowed ahead of his own law, directing state law enforcement agencies to immediately begin arresting people they suspect of entering the state illegally, even though the unconstitutional statute enabling such arrest doesn't even go into effect until March. They have maintained their Texas military lockdown of Shelby Park in Eagle Pass, Texas. On the other hand, the Biden administration has now promised to involve the Justice Department to assert federal jurisdiction over the border. A fascist governor is militarily seizing federal authority, uprooting the federal immigration system and the legitimacy of the U.S. legal system overall, positioning themselves to pick fights with foreign governments. This is the most significant battle between state and federal authority since the end of segregation. But this time, the state is setting the terms, and they are armed, organized, and poised to shoot back against federal forces. For the Democrats in power, this is a fraught situation. They aren't loosening border restrictions. In fact, the Democratic Party has no qualms about taking up and enforcing even more egregious policies to prevent and criminalize immigration. But the fascists are using this one-upmanship of cruelty to weaken and undermine quote-unquote liberal authority that they see as entirely illegitimate. But to the Democrats, the notion of losing legitimacy and welcoming chaos, let alone creating a just and humane border policy, are much scarier than letting the fascists have their way. So they are attempting to cling to the rule of law and democratic norms and keep this powder keg from exploding. However, Biden's only legal recourse is through the fascist PAC Supreme Court. So we'll be continuing to follow this in future episodes. In response to the situation, fascist militias bumped up their border presence once more to terrorize immigrants and anyone who isn't white, while their leader gets space in Newsweek for a whole theocratic QAnon-soaked op-ed full of cruel lies. For all their delusions, they recognize that this will keep going way beyond the normal channels and business as usual. So, good listeners, we gotta ask ourselves, when will our side recognize this and stand up commensurably? The Republican portion of the Iowa caucus has concluded, with Trump receiving more votes than all of his challengers combined. Trump asserted his dominance over the party and the fascist movement, campaigning more from his court appearances in New York and Washington, D.C. than in Iowa. We've been constantly fed this comforting, completely unfounded idea that there would be a last-minute plot twist, that some reasonable person would come to the fore, or that the party would be so divided they just couldn't function. In reality, the fascist movement has only deepened and solidified around Trump over the past 4 years. And in Iowa, in particular, the Christian fascist theocratic element has shown its absolute loyalty to the man, made manifest in the caucus results. They believe that regardless of or even because of his sinfulness, he has delivered them wins like the overturning of abortion rights, and will fight and win for their agenda like no one else. To this movement, morality or even law is nothing compared to God's might. Dahlia Lithwick put the challenge this presents us bluntly in a piece for Slate where she wrote, quote, even holding Donald Trump to account will not necessarily save us from electing Donald Trump the dictator. It could be too slow or too unpersuasive or totally steamrolled by his own destruction tactics. The relevant question is whether we realize in time that the law alone cannot save us. Are we directing all our efforts right now to doing everything and anything else that will? End quote. In addition to all of this, I want to point your attention to two things worth reading. First, Bryn Tannehill's latest piece for The New Republic, The GOP Doesn't Want to Punish Trans People, It Wants to Eradicate Them. It is linked in the show notes. It gets into the 200 plus anti-transgender bills that have already been filed in the states this year. And Rick Perlstein at the New Prospects, incredibly thoughtful series, Metaphors Journalists Live By, which explores why the media is asking the wrong questions and how it might ask better ones. And in the first parts that are released so far, he utilizes the lens of a heated exchange between Jeff Charlotte and a New York Times politics reporter. So check the show notes for a link to that as well. For those who are new listeners to the show, I wanted to offer some context on our use of the word fascist, in addition to welcoming you as a new listener. Thanks for tuning in. As historian Paul Street, who is also a member of the Refuse Fascism editorial board and frequent contributor to the show, has said, quote, "Fascism is not just some angry term of abuse and disparagement to hurl at people you don't like. It is the name of an actual political ideology," end quote. We have posted on our website, refusefascism.org, a definition adapted from our call to action drive out the Trump-Pence regime, issued shortly after the Trump-Pence regime took power. Quote, "Fascism is not just a gross combination of horrific reactionary policies. It is a qualitative change in how society is governed. Fascism foments and relies on xenophobic nationalism, racism, misogyny, and the aggressive reinstitution of oppressive traditional values. Fascist mobs and threats of violence are unleashed to build the movement and consolidate power. What is crucial to understand is that once in power, fascism essentially eliminates traditional democratic rights. Fascism has direction and momentum. Dissent is piece by piece criminalized. The truth is bludgeoned. Group after group is demonized and targeted along a trajectory that leads to real horrors." All of this took dramatic leaps under the Trump-Pence regime. History has shown that fascism must be stopped before it becomes too late, end quote. To close out, I think it's important to remember what we have already endured in Trump's first term and how that relates to fascism as a movement that is not done. And to help us remember that, I wanted to quote from Paul Street again. Street advises that, quote, "Fascism is a social and political ideology and movement that has taken hold of one of the nation's two dominant capitalist imperialist political parties. A fascist occupied the White House for 4 years. He helped stock the federal judiciary with Christian fascists from the Supreme Court on down. More than 20 U.S. states are under Republifascist control, with horrific consequences for their residents' human, civil, reproductive, and environmental rights. Trump and his team tried to overthrow previously normative bourgeois electoral and rule of law democracy in 2021 and is currently sitting pretty for a return to power atop the world's most powerful and dangerous nation, this time with an ambitious authoritarian political and policy agenda worked up by an army of now fascized Republican policy operatives," end quote. With that, here is my conversation with Jen and Brian. To help us in our endeavor to refuse fascism this week, I'm speaking with Jennifer Evans and Brian Griffith, editors of the New Fascism Syllabus Project. Jennifer is a professor of history at Carleton University. Her most recent book is The Queer Art of History, Queer Kinship After Fascism. Brian is an assistant professor of modern European history at California State University, Fresno. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
I have to say, I found this project more recently than I would have liked. I had first found out about your work, I guess it was right around the time of the election, and I had seen news of the open letter that I think Jen and Brian, I think you signed it as well, had issued where you were warning of the danger and the need for everyone, in particular historians and academics, to be shining a light on what you are identifying as a threat to a democracy. I think you had talked in terms of authoritarianism and the threat posed, and you had made connections to what was happening in the United States at that time to what was happening around the world with the rise of fascism. I had wished I had seen it sooner because there are so many great resources on the new fascism syllabus. I say all of that to say, let's start with what is the new fascism syllabus? What have you two and others compiled?
It began its life really in the immediate aftermath of the Trump election in a Facebook Messenger conversation between myself and a colleague who is no longer working on the project because of so many other commitments, Lisa Heineman at the University of Iowa. And she said, there is such a need right now for historians to put this moment in perspective. And we have so much to offer a broader public. We were seeing lots of news articles that just were not very careful with terms and with ideas. And she said, you know, we need something to be able to put our skills to work. And what might that be? And I said, well, you know, we could create a resource. And that's how it all started. And I think Brian saw the earliest attempts and felt that this was something maybe he wanted to also get behind.
Yeah, that's basically the origin story for the project and eventually for my involvement. I was a PhD candidate at the time at UC Santa Barbara working on my dissertation. And a colleague of mine, Dr. Diana Garvin, who's now at the University of Oregon, she also studies the history of Italian fascism, as do I. And she was the one that alerted me to this kind of private Facebook forum group that was really active. And she said, you should be a part of that. And so I went and found it. I requested membership. I was granted membership and immediately was plunged into this incredible conversation that was taking place. Lots of resources were being shared, lots of links to new articles, lots of links to books that were coming down the line, a lot of people debating contemporary politics, not only in the United States and North America, but also across the world. It felt like sort of my historiography put into contemporary motion, and it was really exhilarating and inspiring. And so I wrote to Jen on Facebook Messenger to say, hey, this is a great resource. There seems to be a thing happening here. Why don't we turn this into a website? And so that's what Lisa and Jen and I did. We met at the AHA in 2018 in Washington, D.C., and planned out a several months commitment to translating what we had collected on the Facebook group into a curated resource online. And that's basically the kernel of what you see on newfascismsyllabus.com.
To walk people through a little bit on what they could find there, there is a sample syllabus worthwhile for people to dive in to both sections that you designed. These aren't the ways that you term it, but learning from the past and understanding the present. I think you use the word interrogating. I just think that it's worthwhile for our listeners to understand the process that you went through. When you looked at the past, what you chose to look at, and when you looked at the present, the same thing. How did you identify the themes there?
Yeah. So first of all, we need to situate new fascism syllabus within the kind of broader academic movement of creating these sort of public syllabi. Before us, I'm trying to remember the numbers of syllabi that existed, but Standing Rock syllabus comes to mind. I think there was a Black Lives Matter syllabus, a Charlottesville syllabus. And so these were kind of projects that were percolating on academic Twitter and, you know, among academic circles. And so that's kind of the point of inspiration from which New Fascism syllabus emerged in the first place. We had the great resource of this active Facebook group, which was filled with scholars largely, who were sharing these resources. Anyone could ask a question about a particular field, and you would get a ton of feedback, links to books, links to articles from these individuals. And so we had this incredible resource to draw upon. It wasn't just the three of us curators coming up with all of the materials. We were asking for the experts in their fields to kind of help us find the most relevant, widely cited, most influential literature in their fields. So that's how the kind of wide global approach to the interrogating the past section came together. There was an early debate as to who is our audience? Who are we trying to reach? And we agreed that, of course, other historians who might not be specialists in fascism or authoritarianism were certainly a target demographic for the project. But we also knew that the public was increasingly engaging in comparisons, trying to kind of wrap their minds and their hands around the literature based on historical fascisms and understand to what degree any parallel comparisons are appropriate. And we knew that we needed to provide a kind of short list of readings and resources for those types of people, which include not only members of the public, but also journalists and others who were commenting publicly on these parallels. And so the curated list of different sub-syllabi that are kind of organized around geographical region, Middle East, Europe, North America, are intended to be kind of shorthand, influential historiography and literature on these topics so that they have an opportunity to dive into the most relevant literature on geographical areas.
Brian spoke to the section that deals with the past. The material that is on the interrogating the present section is also a product of that online Facebook community. Those would include the kinds of articles where you do see people commenting on what we're seeing today. So anytime you see a Washington Post, New York Times, The Nation, any kind of public-facing scholarship that is sort of evoking an analysis of the past as a frame, we wanted to capture that. We especially want, and we can't do it with everything because not every book is available as an ebook or public facing, but we wanted another part of the project was about trying to really make stuff accessible. So anything that we could get that was already public facing, publicly accessible without a subscription, we try to give a little bit of priority to that, or at least point in the direction of where somebody might be able to get, you know, a certain book or a certain article without a paywall. So this was also very much in the back of our minds, accessibility, really putting resources in the hands of folks who want more and better information, especially in a moment. And this was 2016. It still feels like it was a long time ago, but this was really at the very beginning of this sort of erosion of public faith and public trust in expertise. And we were really definitely motivated by putting the best quality material out there so that a public could realize that if you wanted an expert on fascism, on Italian fascism, these were the people you would want to consult.
In December 2016, I was part of others with Refuse Fascism, launching a movement of people coming from diverse perspectives, grounded in the understanding of the fascist threat Trump posed, with the mission of stopping this regime before they started, that it evolved into a mission of driving this regime from power through sustained mass nonviolent protest. Because of what we said, the fascist threat that they posed was at that time, even though there was substantiation to that claim, and we involved historians and others that were experts of their field in to make this case to people, we were frequently met with what, in retrospect, I understand is an indictment of our education system, but we were met with the most ignorance around both this country and the history of this country being the United States, and the history of fascism historically, what conditions it arises from, what enables or can pave the way to its rise, the notions of American exceptionalism, that this nation is so unique and so special, that its democracy is so strong that such a threat could never take hold here. Concepts like we aren't those people, and also notions that voting as a mechanism can prevent fascism. The other things that stick with me still, because I see so many of these things reasserting themselves as if he never had a term, as if there was never a coup, as if he didn't do and say all the things he did and said. But what strikes me still is that incompetence, that Trump's too much of a buffoon, too much of a clown. Each of those that I listed, I felt like there's resources in that interrogating the past section of your site that I think is incredibly relevant still for people to understand not only how fascism arises, but how it's able to consolidate power and the myth-making that us Americans like to do about who we are and what we're a part of that I think is relevant. So I just shared that as just some experience. And I was wondering what your experience has been in the reactions to the project, in the conversations that you think are worth sharing, whether they are amongst academics or amongst students at the universities or within public discourse that you think this project has made inroads around.
There is an argument to be made that perhaps the new fascism syllabus, you know, one of the major audiences has been an academic audience, and maybe owing to its origins and the participants, maybe a little bit owing to the blog series that involved scholars really directly and then also gained some attention within the different, we call them historiographical debates, when scholars are sort of fighting out over the semantics of arguments and ideas. So we definitely have made inroads into how historians think about some of these questions and write about these questions. But we also, interestingly, have crossed over into conversations and debates. In Germany, as an example, we made a major intervention, surprisingly, because we are really a very small mom and pop organization of volunteer labor. We managed, through one of our blog series, to intervene in a very high-level public debate around German memory culture, in which a lot of this was playing itself out in their papers of record, their the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, their Washington Post, their New York Times. And that was really interesting on a number of levels because we had something to offer. We are also an online publication. To be able to do that kind of work, that kind of intervention, is really quite something, really literally sort of shifting the discourse around how to think about how far Germany has come in dealing with the after effects of National Socialism amidst a longer history of German colonialism.
Yeah, well, the open letter was mentioned at the beginning of this episode, and that was certainly a moment when the project punctured the public conversation, at least in the United States. That public letter was signed by around 280 scholars of authoritarianism, fascism, Nazism from around the world. Some of them really high profile scholars, including people like Robert Paxton, Christopher Browning, and others. And it also was covered by The Guardian and The Washington Post. And so we gained some traction there. The blog series that Jen mentioned, the open letter, you know, the website itself, these are humble but important contributions to trying to impact the public conversation and debate over what phenomena it is that we're experiencing at this present time. It's an open debate among scholars about how to use labels. We've chosen to be very careful about our language on purpose in order to allow for that debate to exist and not to be, partisans in that conversation. But we hope to inject information and literature and kind of highlight the knowledge that has been produced to date on historical fascisms and provide those resources to the users that come to our site, that read our blog, that listen to episodes like this to do those analyses on their own.
Let's go there a little bit more in terms of how you see the role that your project plays now. And it's January, the election will be in November. It's clear he is the nominee. I think if people are putting all their hopes in a legal strategy that somehow holds him accountable and prevents him from being the nominee, we got to break with that because that's not in line right now with the trajectory in terms of timelines. What do you see your work looking like in this fraught moment?
Jen and I have partnered the last few years on this project, and the project has come in spurts and starts. A project forms around a particular debate. For example, on the blog series, we've had the catechism debate, we've had a Ukraine series. So things come along that fit into the structure of this project, and we take the project in that direction. So in some ways, we're responding to events on the ground, and we're thinking through contemporary challenges. In that spirit, there's no long-term strategy for 11 months from now. We'll probably be paying attention to 2024 and thinking of ways in which the new fascism syllabus can play a role in shaping conversations. Jen, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, the other thing that's worth noting in terms of our syllabus is that it hasn't been America-focused. One of the things about it is that it's not explicitly, but it's pretty much a kind of and the rest of the world focus, largely because there, again, like Brian said at the outset, there are these really excellent syllabus projects that look at aspects of the American story. We deliberately have shone a light elsewhere. And so for us, as an example right now, I mean, we have been, you know, looking at everything that's unfolding in other parts of the world and thinking like, is this a place where we want to intervene? There are challenges in doing so, both on the level of, on an intellectual level of doing it mindfully and responsibly, and also in terms of workload, because we have other hats that we wear. It's hard for us to know right now what these next months will look like because we're also reacting to how historians are responding to what they are seeing. It's a little bit of an example of where we responded to the crisis in governance in Israel with our series, whereas we've stayed out of the war in Gaza for all sorts of reasons because it doesn't entirely fit our remit. But so this is how we're reacting to world events. We've always wanted to do more. We've got Southeast Asia with India, with the kind of extremism, authoritarianism we're seeing there. But that's also been a question of resources in terms of who might be brought on board to maybe undertake a blog series. And we face these kinds of very real world challenges around resources and attention. And
I was going to ask you, as you were talking about other places in the world and the work that the earlier round kind of highlighted certain places, and I was wondering where you feel in the next, let's say, year, people should be paying some attention to in terms of the threat that's posed there. India is definitely on my mind. I'm also thinking about Argentina. Are there places that you feel people should be learning more about right now?
Yeah, I have a couple of things that have been on my mind. Of course, the India context under Modi has been a long-forming political crisis in that country, Hindu nationalism, and bearing some fingerprints of fascist thought. I'm concerned about that. And yeah, the most recent elections in Argentina were quite surprising, especially, you know, given this individual's, is it Milei, I think is his last name. I don't think that the fascist label has been thrown around, but he's certainly somewhat of an anarcho-capitalist ultra-populist and carries himself in a strongman fashion. Certainly, I can foresee there being interventions that this project makes. If we can get the right people together, I'm thinking Federico Finkelstein might be really great for that. But also in my own field, you know, I'm a Europeanist, as is Jen, and Italy, there is a less extremist party currently in power in sort of outward expression and form, but which has roots to the fascist party. So this is Giorgia Meloni's Fratelli d'Italia party, the Brothers of Italy. The Brothers of Italy emerged out of the collapsed Movimento Sociale Italiano, the Italian social movement, which was formed in 1946 by members of Mussolini's second regime, the Italian Social Republic, which was the regime that technically crumbled in 1945 with the partisan resistance and the Allied forces moving in. Members of that regime survived and formed an openly neo-fascist party in 1946 when Italy became a republic. And that party lasted until, I believe it was 1995 or 1996, and then ended up collapsing. And there were a couple of successor parties, which resulted in the formation of Fratelli d'Italia. And if you actually look at Fratelli d'Italia's logo, they bear the original logo of the MSI, the Italian Social Movement, which is a tricolor flame in their logo. So first of all, they have these deep roots that stretch back to the end of World War II. And during her upbringing, Giorgia Meloni was a member of the Fronte della Gioventù, Youth Front, which was the MSI's neo-fascist youth group. She became a national leader of its successor group in the mid-1990s, and then went on to form Fratelli d'Italia in 2012. She and her party, they've sort of rebranded themselves as liberal democrats, as conservatives. They call themselves conservatives. They call themselves sovereignists, which is sort of a dog whistle synonym for ideas relating to fascism. There have been some talks of changing the constitution, commemoration of fascist martyrs from the 1970s and 80s during a period of time in Italy known as the Years of Lead, the Anni di Piombo, which was a period when far left and far right youth groups and parties and militias fought each other in the streets of Italy. There has been this sort of slow creep in Italy, really for years, but really culminating now with Giorgia Meloni's prime ministry, of bringing fascist ideas and commemorations slowly and gradually and slightly imperceptibly back into the public sphere. And I think this has culminated just a couple of weeks ago. The international news was reporting on this nighttime march in Rome, where everyone was giving the fascist salute. Now, of course, the media incorrectly represented this as something new. This has been going on for decades, only now catching the attention of the international media. But I think under Meloni, under a Fratelli d'Italia-led government, this is resonating in a new and fresh way. I'm concerned. I'm watching very carefully things in Italy. I'm sure Jen might be able to speak a little bit on AfD in Germany, which is another area of concern, a kind of party that bears a fascist resemblance, and they're on the rise in that country. The National Front, which might be called just the Front now, in France, Marine Le Pen, is another area of concern. It was a narrow loss to Macron in the most recent elections. She was very close in the polls. So I think Europe in general is something that I'm looking at very closely. And another one that comes to mind is Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, who's just recently become, I believe, prime minister, or is currently engaged in putting together a coalition government there.
He's a great example of what we thought could never be can totally happen. I just remember him in the Michael Moore movie a bunch of years back, where he was like the laughable prop in something.
Yeah, and he has kind of clownish features like Donald Trump and kind of carries himself in that pompous fashion. I first met Geert Wilders in the literary sense in reading Murder in Amsterdam by Ian Buruma. And Geert was sort of a minority young politician at that point, because that book was published, you know, about 20 years ago, who was on the extreme far right fringe. And I think at that time, he kind of felt like an exceptional political character. But now, could be leading the Dutch government. So we're in a moment where these things are percolating, not just into the news, but into government. And we have to be vigilant. And I think New Fascism Syllabus is here for that conversation.
I would say, too, that it's worth considering going forward. And again, we have no plans. But one of the things that we have seen and that I know is part of the conversation among scholars, and that is not just a focus on the usual suspects, the Geert Wilders, the AfD, the Giorgia Meloni, but how far their ideas that used to be fringe have migrated into the center and are taken up gleefully by members of the center in moments of stress and concern. And so one great example of that would be the challenge in Germany right now over how to maintain a pluralist, open conversation around what's happening in the Middle East, but also around migrants and where dangerous ideas originate and come from. And so the Islamophobia that we're seeing that's normalized increasingly in the center is something that is increasingly part of the landscape. And so it's not fascism per se, but it is about an openness to more extreme ideas in sort of the legitimate spaces of governance. And that's where it may not be the remit of the New Fascism Syllabus, but it could be where we all might want to start paying a little bit more attention, because it's also, of course, something that links my country in terms of, you know, an election we're going to have in another year's time with a conservative party that is definitely playing to a base that finds some of these ideas, anti-immigration, front and center. So if we were to gauge, that might be something that we might all want to spend some time considering and looking at.
I think that point is very well taken, and something that on this show we're going to try to be putting more attention on. I think we spoke last week about the data that had just come out around reactions to Trump's rhetoric around poisoning the blood of our nation, the anti-immigrant rhetoric, and the reception that it was given. There's the reception from those that rule, but there's also the reception of, amongst not just his base, but people broadly. It was like 75% of Republicans polled in by YouGov responded favorably, that they agreed with it. It was nearly half of those polled, regardless of party, but there was definitely a difference between those who self-identified as Republican and those that didn't. It just shows that there is a mainstreaming of it. And even while we see the makings of what could be a civil war speeding up in Texas over immigration that many people look at in horror, there's still so many people in this country, their friends, their family, who listen to language like that and don't just remain passive, but listen with glee. That's something that we have to confront and understand. So I definitely appreciate that. I wanted to end with one last question. Since you are both really well-read folks, I wanted to ask you for some book recommendations or a podcast or listening option as well, if that's more your thing. But for our listeners, for a primarily non-academic audience, what is the thing that you think most speaks to you right now for this moment?
For a non-academic audience, something that would be a good primer, I think, on thinking about historical fascisms and thinking about sort of the mechanisms and processes by which they come to power, the historical pressures that influence their rise, right? So thinking along those lines, I'm not entirely sure that I found a better example of this than Robert Paxton's The Anatomy of Fascism. And I think that was written, it's published, I believe, by Vintage. I think that was written for that in mind, for not only undergraduate audiences, but also just general readership. And it does a good job of kind of systematically dissecting the histories of, well, European interwar fascism. So it's mainly Italy and Germany that's examined, but not in a chronological fashion, but in a kind of process fashion. Anyone who's interested in kind of digging into those processes and those historical pressures and circumstances and contexts, I think would get a lot out of Paxton's The Anatomy of Fascism.
I was thinking about people and projects that are interesting to me. And one of the people that I find very interesting and I go to all the time when trying to think through some of these issues is Cynthia Miller Idris at American University and her Peril Lab. They do really interesting work, both for teachers, for educators, but also in terms of putting some of these debates into a language, into a context that is accessible. And she's also a commentator often on MSNBC and other spaces. Her work is really great. There's also a really nice blog out of, I think it's Central European University. It's called RevDem. They often will host scholars who will, you know, be presenting books, not just on historical fascism, but also on the crisis of liberalism. So this is a nice space to go and just hear scholars, you know, much in the same way as this podcast, right? Speak to their work and how it resonates in the current moment.
I wanted to thank you both so much for coming on to share with us your expertise, your perspective, and your time. And I wanted to ask if people want to learn more, read more from you, follow your work, where should they go? Where we'll obviously be posting a link to the new fascism syllabus, but anywhere else that you want to guide people to?
I might just direct our listeners to our X and Blue Sky, and I believe we have Facebook, and we might even have Mastodon. I can't recall if those accounts are all still active, but we do frequently post on social media beyond content that we have on the website. Of course, we promote our content via those social media accounts as well, but oftentimes there's additional conversations and debates and resources being shared on social media. If any of the listeners are on any of those platforms, search us out and follow us, and we'll see you there.
And just one other possibility, and it's maybe more for folks who are researching some of these themes. I'm also the primary investigator on a project called Populist Publics, run out of Carleton University. And one of the things that we have done is we have scraped data sets and are increasingly making those available through our university repository. But if people have the resources, have the access, and are interested in publicly shared data sets, things like large-scale data hauls of Twitter, when Twitter used to allow us to do this, on a variety of themes and hashtags, then that might be worth earmarking as something to look for in the future.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So here we are. In 10 months, Biden could win the election and the Republic of Fascists could refuse to accept the results, as they have already made clear they pledged to, with all the violence and terror that would bring, or the increasingly likely and frightening possibility that Trump re-seizes the White House legally, thanks to voter suppression, gerrymandering, the Electoral College, etc., with all the violent retribution, the terror, and nightmare that would unleash, what they are promising right now. Yes, there could also be no election, because that's the world the Republic of Fascists are creating, and we are just living in it. Given these possibilities as all realistic outcomes, what I am struck with right now is the desire for people to turn away, either because they sense the profound danger posed by Trump and MAGA, and they feel the horror inevitable, immutable, or because they are sickened by the genocide in Gaza made possible by the USA and cannot see beyond the voting booth, or because even the worst of Trump has been normalized, willful self-delusion that maybe it wasn't that bad, or that it couldn't be done again, or we survived it. And definitely, it couldn't be worse. The political amnesia whole generations who have lived under endless war committed at the hands of their government are all too familiar with. Or perhaps that Trumpism, fascism is just another acceptable way politics is done. Forget the kids in cages, the Muslims banned, the shithole countries, the big lie, January 6th. It's the American way to turn away from the larger world and focus on the self and maybe family, to turn off a reality show that is just so shitty, filled with obnoxious, no longer novel characters and a plot that you feel is predetermined. Michelle Goldberg puts her finger on the pulse of an aspect of this in what she refers to as disengagement, writing for the New York Times, quote, "A few overarching questions animated Trump's first term. Can he really get away with this? When will Republicans break with him? Will the law ever catch up?" In a second Trump presidency, those questions would be answered. Yes, never, and no. The constant hope that Trump could be exposed and even ousted would be gone. Thus, among liberals, I suspect the anxious hypervigilance sparked by Trump's first election would be replaced, at least initially, by depression, end quote. She goes on to say, quote, "Trump keeps doing appalling things. In just the past couple of days, he nearly got thrown out of the second defamation trial brought against him by a woman who, according to a jury, he sexually abused, and then claimed on social media that presidents should enjoy absolute immunity from criminal prosecution, even when they, quote unquote, cross the line. But his misdeeds have lost the capacity to shock, and they no longer drive conversations," end quote. But we do not have to resign ourselves and humanity to this cruel and brutal future. And we don't have to be good old American parasites embracing individualism on the spoils of empire. While there is a clear moral imperative to refuse fascism, an imperative that you listeners feel deeply, why you haven't put your head in the sand, ignored suffering, damned the consequences, succumbed to the notion, it's not happening to me yet, therefore why should I care? It is also true that none of this is inevitable. A fascist outcome isn't destined by the gods. We have efficacy, but only if we actually pay attention, sound the alarm, pull others out of this burning building, and shake the slumbering awake. That's what we hope to do together this year with you. Thanks for listening to Refuse Fascism. We want to hear your thoughts, your ideas for topics, for guests. We want to hear what questions you have, what is keeping you up at night in relation to the fascist threat that Trump and the whole GOP poses. So check the show notes. There's a survey there. Take just a few moments, answer a few questions to help us shape this show for a year where we are needed, all of us, more than ever. As always, you can also reach me at the site previously known as Twitter, at Sam B. Goldman. Drop me a line at SamanthaGoldman@refusefascism.org. Find Refuse Fascism on social media at Threads, Mastodon, Blue Sky, Instagram at Refuse Fascism. I now have a TikTok, even though I still haven't figured out how to use it. Help me, join me on that journey over at Sam Goldman RF, or we want to hear your voice. Leave us a voicemail with your thoughts, questions, suggestions. See the show notes for the voicemail button. And if you want to support the show, in addition to filling out the survey, it's super simple. Show us some love by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And of course, follow, subscribe so you never miss an episode. Become a patron to support our pod and content creation to help people understand and act to stop the fascist threat. We have no sponsors, as it is obvious, and we truly count on you. Whether you can give $2 or $20 a month, it all makes a difference in producing and promoting this independent, all-volunteer weekly podcast. Give today at patreon.com/refusefascism. Or visit refusefascism.org and smash that donate button. Select recurring donation to make it monthly. Thank you for your support. Thanks to Richie Marini, Lena Thorne, and Mark Tingleman for helping produce this episode. Thanks to incredible volunteers, we have transcripts available for each show. So be sure to visit refusefascism.org and sign up to get them in your inbox. Until next Sunday, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America.